This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Efforts to combat heroin use in Wisconsin have continued to gain attention, with Governor Scott Walker even calling a special legislative session to address the issue earlier this year. But a recent study by the Wisconsin Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation found methamphetamine may be the new drug to worry about. Between 2011 and 2015, meth-related cases in Wisconsin increased by almost 300% and have especially affected western Wisconsin. Joining us to talk about the growing prevalence of meth are Tom Johnson, Investigative Coordinator for the West Central Metropolitan Enforcement Group, Cheryl Hancock, Executive Director of Cooley Council on Addictions, and Al Bliss, Health Educator for the La Crosse County Health Department. So as I mentioned, this FBI study that was recently published, you know, found that meth use has quietly surged to be on par with heroin over the last few years. Those were their words. And Tom, you know, why is nobody talking about this kind of, you know, resurgence of meth use in Wisconsin?
Well, I think methamphetamine use was kind of a sleeper, so to speak, for a number of years. And heroin and the opioids did get the majority of the attention from most groups. But it just went along and along, and finally, people finally realized that meth was definitely making a surge. And as you mentioned, there was about a 300% increase, actually. And I think what happened, essentially, was what happened was information was given out from, like, the Heroin and Illicit Drug Task Force and a number of other groups that educated the people, educated the addicts, educated the users. And we had such an influx of overdose deaths and survivor overdose that I think some of the people actually became fearful, finally, and started looking at methamphetamine as an alternative.
And methamphetamine is not, you know, necessarily a new drug to Wisconsin. I know that it was a problem, you know, a number of years ago. So, you know, Tom, can you talk a little bit about kind of the history behind meth use in this region?
Well, methamphetamine really came into its own during World War II. It was used extensively by the Allied and Nazi troops both, in terms of keeping the pilots awake on long flight missions, keeping the infantry soldiers keyed up and alert during long ordeals in the battlefield. After World War II, there were a number of motorcycle gangs, for instance, on the West Coast that needed a way to make a living, and they brought some of their information back from the war in terms of how to make methamphetamine. So it just started to grow mainly from the West Coast, and it just spread to the Midwest. During the late 80s and 90s in particular, we had a real surge of meth labs in western Wisconsin particularly. But they were larger labs and what we referred to as garage labs, and used a lot of anhydrous ammonia that were stolen from, like, farm and agricultural areas. So there's been a change in tide, so to speak, in the way the methamphetamine is manufactured. But generally, it just moved from the West Coast into the Midwest.
You know, as we're, you know, talking about heroin right now, may be the more, I guess, more popular to talk about drug issue right now. But, you know, Cheryl, can you talk about, you know, what are the differences and maybe similarities between heroin use and meth use?
Well, I think any time a person misuses a drug, or the drug affects their life in a way that they can no longer manage a regular lifestyle, that whether it's heroin or whether it's meth, that they have the same outcomes. And oftentimes that use may start off very small, very incrementally. I would suggest that the whole reason that heroin had gotten so much attention as of late is because of the deaths that were happening, where meth is more of a chronic use, long-term use occurs, and then they're going to start seeing the after effects, physical, but they wouldn't necessarily die from one injection, one use of the drug. And so anytime you see that surge, you have to be concerned. And so many of the people who opioid misuse has occurred is because of prescription drugs. And so it is the neighborhoods, the middle class folks who are overdosing to that. And it caught attention of a number of folks that maybe in the past wouldn't have talked about it. But now because they're seeing relatives and family members and loved ones that are affected, they're bringing it to the front. And then as organizations like the Heroin and Other Illicit Drug Task Force were looking at things and looking at statistics, I think they found that, hey, heroin and opioids is one thing, but let's look at the number of arrests and things that are occurring in La Crosse County alone. And the numbers were higher and higher. And so at one point in time, they actually added that other illicit drugs to the task force name because they realized, or we realized, I'm a member of the task force, that it's not just the opioids that are affecting our neighborhoods and our communities. And so, again, anytime that illicit use of drugs affects their lifestyle, their living, it becomes a problem.
Yeah, and Al, is meth use, I guess, something that, you know, the La Crosse County Heroin and Illicit Drug Task Force is, you know, looking at? Is this something that is on your radar?
It is on the radar. In fact, we invited Investigator Tom Johnson to come and speak to the task force not too far from the inception of the task force when it began in 2013. And at that point, we wanted to go beyond heroin and some of the synthetic painkillers or the opioids. And so we did do some education. We did do some awareness. We got our task force up to speed. We didn't necessarily do real different specific strategies to address meth, but the education and the awareness was one of the things that the task force realistically, you know, could do within the community. Is, you know, you have to build up some of that awareness and some of that support. Certainly the numbers out there, if you look at, you know, what Tom will probably talk about later, are the drug charges. They're quite, you know, astounding. I mean, there's among some of the highest numbers out there for the charges compared to some of the other drugs that's found on the street.
Yeah, and Tom, you started to touch on this earlier, but, you know, why are we really seeing this resurgence of meth right now?
Well, there's a big difference between meth and heroin in terms of the viability of the user. Methamphetamine is similar to cocaine, a stimulant. It's a poor man's cocaine is a lot of times what people call meth. But people that use meth are from somewhat a different demographic age group. It could be from, say, 18 through the 40s and 50s. I know of people in their 50s that are still using methamphetamine. Some people use it to sharpen their responses, to stay awake longer, to do what they think is a better job at their place of employment, to keep them more alert. So if they have established a baseline of how much meth it takes to keep them going, they're able to actually function, as compared to the heroin addict who becomes basically non-functional. These people they just become addicted to heroin and it consumes their entire life physically and mentally as well. So there's a big difference there.
Who is using meth? You started to touch on, you know, it can be a broad range of ages, but, you know, is this more of an issue for urban areas or for rural areas?
I have to tell you, it hits all demographics, really, in all areas. Our task force, the West Central Meg Unit, is comprised of Trempealeau, Jackson, La Crosse, Monroe, and Vernon counties. So I see it from all areas, from the population density area here in La Crosse, and then it spreads out to predominantly rural areas in those other counties. And we're seeing that meth use just being steady throughout those areas. There's no sweet spot, so to speak, where it doesn't exist.
And can you talk a little bit more about the West Central Metropolitan Enforcement Group, or MEG unit, that you mentioned?
Well, the MEG unit was initiated in about 1987, and it was formulated off a federal grant called the Edward Byrne Grant. It was named after a young police officer in New York that was murdered on a drug surveillance. That grant was supposed to be a short-lived thing. We are still operating under that grant, although with greatly reduced funds, of course. But it has gone on forever. It's provided funding for us to be a collaborative group in these five counties. About 7 years ago, we created the position that I currently hold, And my job is to make sure that the investigators in all five of those counties and the 17 agencies that are members of that unit are aware of what each other is doing. What we have found throughout the years here, especially in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, with the advent of social media, the interstates, the ability to travel much easier and quicker, is that the drug activity is spread out. People don't just stay in their own counties and sell drugs. We have conspiracy cases that we work that entail all five counties now. In the old days when people would go to one end of the other of the county to get drugs, now people are driving to Chicago or Minneapolis, St. Paul, and things like that. It's a much smaller world, so we have to be more collaborative in nature in our investigative technique.
As Tom was talking about, you know, meth seems to be a drug that's really affecting kind of all communities from rural to urban. And Cheryl, can you, you know, talk a little bit more about, you know, what you are seeing at Cooley Council on Addictions when it comes to meth use? You know, kind of what are some of the trends that you're seeing?
Well, I think that, as Tom said, it doesn't discriminate. People from all backgrounds, all walks of life are using meth. What we're finding and hearing about from some of our visitors are that they may be using heroin for one reaction and meth for another. And so they actually interchange it. And as we were doing some research not too long ago, we found a statistic that said two-thirds of all illicit drug users are fully employed. And you think about that when you're talking to employers, when they're talking about absenteeism and they're talking about safety and security and those sorts of things, that two-thirds of all illicit drug users, so people who may have had a prescription for an opioid and are now using it inappropriately, but two-thirds of all illicit drug users. So as Tom talked about, those who will use meth to keep them awake and that sort of thing, It's a huge number, and I think we are all affected by it, and we see that at Cooley too. People from all walks of life, all backgrounds are coming to find that support and long-term recovery, and that's the promising thing is recovery does happen each and every day at our organization.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about the rise of meth use in western Wisconsin. We're here with Cheryl Hancock from Cooley Council on Addictions, Al Bliss from the La Crosse County Health Department, and Tom Johnson from the West Central Metropolitan Enforcement Group. You mentioned two-thirds of all illicit drug users are fully employed. I mean, Al, I feel like that really shines a light on why this is a significant public health issue.
It really is. And in fact, even when we look at some of the numbers of those individuals using opioids and heroin, if we look at the age range from the overdose deaths, it's not somebody in their 20s or mid-20s. The average age for our region was 46 years of age. That might surprise some individuals as well. Talking about some of the drugs always seems like bad news. I do have some good news to share is that the Youth Risk Behavior Survey was completed, and the first time the meth question was actually asked among the high school students within our county, and 1.5% of students answered that they had used meth within the past 30 days. We didn't ask about lifetime use, so that might have been an increase if we had asked that. So even though that is seems like a low number, if you look at the total number of high school students living within our county, we probably have nearly 8,000 high school students. So we still have dozens of individuals who have used or reported using meth within the past 30 days that are in high school. But I think it's promising in the fact that we're able now to specifically measure that within our region. Without some of these numbers, I mean, we don't really know where we're always going, so I think that's important. The other promising thing, too, has to do a lot with what Cheryl does and the people in support and recovery, is that Gunderson actually does have a program for those that are addicted to stimulants, and it's, I believe it's called the Matrix program, which is an evidence-based program, 16 weeks, and it's combined with cognitive behavioral therapy and then the support as well. The county at one time was going to be offering that, and I think that the hope is in the future they will do that. So those are two kind of promising things, I guess, because we talk so much about all the negative things. I think we need to keep in mind what are some of the good things that are happening.
I mean, Cheryl, how does How does someone get to, you know, to start using meth? How does someone develop an addiction?
Well, addiction is a brain disease, and so sometimes it can be that one time they've been prescribed an opioid, and that is what it takes for them then to go down that road. But it is a brain disease, and the effect that it has, you've got student A maybe sitting next to student B or individual A and B, and they each use the same substance, and one will have a different effect on than the other, and that's because it's a brain disease, and those who unfortunately have that, it's a lifelong brain disease, and it's something that they will have to struggle with the rest of their life or find recovery and rejoice in the rest of their life. But it is something that no matter how much family support or how much love or whatever you have in your background, if you have that disease, you have that disease.
Tom, I mean, have you, I guess, seen any trends of kind of how people kind of come to using meth?
Well, I think it starts at a young age with upbringing, family background, love and support from friends and relatives and so forth. I have the opportunity oftentimes to interview inmates who suddenly see the way and want to talk to an investigator about their life and whatever. But it always boils down to a rough upbringing. I shouldn't say always, but majority of the time it boils down to some sort of issue or dysfunction in their early life, whether it be really young or teens or whatever. The other part of the equation is drug business from an enforcement standpoint is it's an economic thing. It's Econ 101. The people that are pushing the drugs into the area are the ones that are making the money. We don't have drug dealers, particularly in the heroin side of it, that are making lots of money here in La Crosse or any one of the counties. We do have people that are pushing methamphetamine into this area that are turning lots and lots of cash. So they push the methamphetamine onto these people. You have your main suppliers, you have your middlers, and then you have the users. And the middlers have told me, in fact, that they are being pushed to sell more and more and more. And once they commit themselves to that lifestyle, it's then expected by the larger groups, cartel-related groups, that they will continue to sell. So part of it's we have a target-rich environment with the colleges and universities in that age group or whatever in this area, and it just happens. And this area is not the only one that has that.
What they're finding statistically is that mental health, mental illness goes hand in hand with folks who are struggling with addiction. And oftentimes, as Tom said, something in their youth may have happened. Trauma is found to go hand in hand with addiction as well. And especially in women, the high number, I think the statistics are between 85 and 90% of women who are addicts and are interviewed have found to have some sort of trauma in their early life. And so those are the kind of things that can affect a person's ability to find that, work with that disease.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of preventative things can we as a community be doing to, I guess, prevent future meth use?
Well, I think education is really key. Cooley Council is really proud of its prevention programming that we've been doing for a number of years. We were in the Holman and West Salem school districts providing prevention education. It's a evidence-based program called Too Good for Drugs, and we were doing that in the kindergarten through fifth grade in those two school districts. And then also have an expansion of that grant or of a grant to allow us to provide it in the other school districts, maybe in some of the alternative schools, or even this summer we're looking at the Boys and Girls Club and the Y Teen Center and those sorts of opportunities for us to bring in that curriculum and the school that is year-round school. So we're trying to expand on that. And how that is evidence-based is that it is an annual presentation, multiple hours in the classroom by the instructor, who really talks about age appropriateness of decision making, making good decisions, making bad decisions. But then they see them in the first grade, and they see them in the second grade, and third grade, fourth grade. So it's not just a 1 year thing, and it kind of complements what they do with the DARE program, but that it is over and over and over again, that positive messaging. And, you know, we're trying to elicit some of those statistics to show whether that's had an impact or not. But a lot of the things are confidential. A lot of the stats are confidential, so it's hard to measure. But we know that it's evidence-based, and that the more the message, that positive message can be given, the more beneficial it can be to the youth.
Yeah, and Al, I mean, you know, what is La Crosse County doing, I guess, to kind of take a preventative approach to meth use in our area?
Sure. The Heroin and Illicit Drug Task Force, you know, besides meeting on a regular basis and doing various prevention activities and education, you know, as Cheryl mentioned, I think it's real important to work on other prevention efforts. And the work that they do in the school is very commendable, and it's necessary. Those are very good dollars and well spent. The same would go for public safety, which involves Tom Johnson with the Metropolitan Enforcement Group is very important. There's two other areas. One would certainly be the treatment, which, you know, Cheryl, I think, would be able to touch on more. But the other strategy is some of the harm reduction strategies that need to be implemented. So it's a very complex problem, but all four of these, I'll call them pillars. So we've got prevention, harm reduction, public safety, and treatment are needed. You know, that all sounds great, but I'd say, what is the task force doing? One of the things we're doing is looking at why the drug-related hospitalizations have increased. They've gone up astronomically. Just from Gunderson alone, in 2016, there was nearly 3,000 drug-related hospitalizations, and almost 25% of those are related to stimulants. They don't break them down and say it's meth, but many of them would be. Many of them would be considered that. There's also a problem with the number of marijuana drug-related hospitalizations, which people don't realize as well. That's almost another 25% if you look at the numbers. And then certainly prescription drugs, painkillers, and opioids make up a greater part of the other percentage. So looking at why some of these hospitalizations are occurring and what we can do, one thing that I'm involved with, in fact, Cheryl is one of the co-chairs, is for a group, we call it the Lighthouse Group, and it's really to look at a peer-run respite type center. And a peer-run respite center, it functions, the purpose of it is to try to meet people with where they're at, where they can't get into treatment before something, you know, really terrible happens. And often they're in the gaps where they can't get treatment, they don't have insurance, they just need a few days at least to unwind and be able to figure these things out with staff that would be like peer coaches, have been through it before and successful and that are trained. So I think that's something that the task force is looking at, and how we can set up something like that. And so basically it would be like a house that would be would support these individuals and be staffed by peer support specialists and operated that way to be able to assist. So that's been a big project that we are currently working on. And again, to look at some of the other locations of where the hospitalizations resulted from in more detail, I think will hopefully help protect those individuals, but also, you know, our community.
That's Al Bliss from the La Crosse County Health Department here with us today to talk about trends in meth and other drug use affecting Western Wisconsin. Also joining us is Cheryl Hancock from Cooley Council on Addictions and Tom Johnson from the West Central Metropolitan Enforcement Group. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. And Tom, you know, we've been talking about meth use as kind of a public health issue, but, you know, in what ways is meth use and meth production a public safety issue as well from a law enforcement standpoint?
Well, when we talk about production, we need to talk about the two different styles of methamphetamine that are predominant. And we have the most predominant methamphetamine being marketed in the area right now is what we call ice or crystal meth. That's a really high-grade methamphetamine that is produced in super labs, generally in Mexico, some in California, but most of that is imported into the area. High grade, high toxicity, sought after, and relatively cheap. The other kind of methamphetamine that we see, I mentioned earlier about the old garage labs of yesteryear. Some street Einsteins have now realized that they could figure out their own meth production, and they've created what we refer to as the one pot or the shake and bake method. And basically all that is it's just a lower grade, poorer quality meth, but it can be made relatively quickly with all ingredients, precursor chemicals and things that we all have in our households or our garages. Basically what they do is they put the ingredients in one vessel, like a 2-liter pot bottle or a Gatorade style bottle, and put everything together in there, shake it, agitate it, adjust the pressure with the cap, very unscientific. And they generally come up with a bunch of methamphetamine, could be half a gram or a gram, enough for personal use or for some of the people that have helped them get the precursor chemicals. So that's a huge thing. And what happens there is we're dealing with hazardous waste. So when these people make their methamphetamine, they generally throw off the bottles into road ditches and things like that. And you have like lithium batteries, sulfuric acid, hydriatic acid, sodium nitrate, things like that, that now have become a hazardous materials that people can be exposed to.
You mentioned it's, this shake and bake or one pot method, you know, very unscientific is the phrase you use. I mean, is that something that is concerning, that this kind of activity could be happening, you know, on the street, in the car, down the road?
Well, we've run into a number of times where people put their precursor chemicals together in this vessel, and then half the time they're high themselves, so they have a limited amount of judgment that they can use. They drive around in their car, they keep shaking the bottle, the pressure. What happens is you have heat reactions inside the bottle. There's two or three reactions going on at one time. So it creates heat, the plastic expands, and unless the top is cracked and the pressure is allowed to release, the bottle will compromise and basically explode in your lap. The fire reactions going on can burn the plastic and compromise the bottom of the bottle, so to speak. So it's very dangerous. Again, as you said, they could be driving down the street right beside you. You just wouldn't know it.
And as you've mentioned, you know, this is kind of, a new method, not just the kind of garage labs that we'd seen in previous years. And so I wonder what new, methods we have to kind of combat this and kind of discover this sort of activity.
Well, we use public education to a great extent, particularly with young people, but I give lots of presentations to township associations, JCs, church groups. There's no limit to the types of people that we get that message out to. We talk to people that are involved in roadside cleanup, because I'm always concerned about the young people reaching down and tipping a bottle over and starting a reaction again, so they have what we refer to as a rolling lab. We did a presentation thing in Trempealeau County last year where we talked to at every high school and every hospital and every medical center and clinic in the entire county. The sheriff and I went out and met with those people, gave them the information about these meth labs and what to watch for. So that's really the only way we can combat it, because we have no way of knowing who's got one in their car with them at any given time.
Cheryl, and I wonder, how have we changed our approach to dealing with people who are battling addiction to meth?
Well, I think we are always looking at and becoming more informed and educated as far as addiction and what we can do in treatment. I know that currently people are looking at treatment differently than it just put them in residential treatment, 30 days, wham, bam, they're out and they're cured, quote, unquote. And you're never cured of this disease. It's a lifelong disease. And so they're looking at more of a holistic approach to treatment that, yes, they may have residential studies show that for meth especially and heroin, that it takes extended inpatient or residential time, not just that 30 days, that it's probably 60 to 90 days that they need. And then once they've completed that, that's kind of the mindset the head kind of part of treatment, but we should be looking at mind, spirit, body sorts of treatment as well. So reintegrating them into society, because many of these folks, that has been their life, that has become their life, depending on how chronic the disease is for them. They wake up in the morning and their whole role in life was to figure out how to get their next hit, and then how to get the money to get their next hit, and then how to get their next hit. And so they now have to be reintroduced into life and into society. And so organizations like Cooley, that's what we do, is we provide those opportunities for them to find new playground, new playmates, people to have a positive journey instead of that negative journey. And that evidence base, that is this, what studies are finding, is that you need to have that. And then also things like meditation and the spiritual part of recovery for some, especially the 12-step program, is very spiritual. It has the higher power. There are some programs that don't include that. Smart recovery, which is evidence-based and really is about abstinence. It's abstinence-based. And so they have, in the last few years, come a long way in re-looking at what treatment is and what happens after treatment. And some of this can go hand-in-hand with people who are in intensive outpatient. But it's one thing to have the head kind of dealt with. You have to have that mind, body, and spirit dealt with as well.
And Al, obviously the Heroin and Illicit Drug Task Force is something new that the county is using to kind of deal with these issues. But I wonder if you have other thoughts on how, what new approaches or methods does the county and local communities have to approach meth use?
Sure. I think some of this goes along with what Cheryl was saying, that people who have substance use disorder or addicted to drugs need a lot of support in order to succeed. And sometimes individuals who use drugs do a lot of things that we don't like. But if we don't help them, change isn't really going to happen. And so we really have to rethink about how we view somebody that does have substance use disorder or that's addicted to drugs. And so they do need this support. I mean, they need to have meaning in their life. They need to have a job. They need to have happiness. They need often mental health support. Those things are very important. At our next task force meeting, we've invited an individual to come in to speak about a program called Project Proven, for example, so that our task force learns about more resources that are available. And Project Proven really is a program to help those that are moving from being incarcerated or jailed to being able to excel outside of being in jail and what it takes to be successful. And so we need more programs like that. We need to have the community informed so that others can get involved and take advantage of programs like that. So connecting them to services like that and just coordinating that is really important. And with the participation that we have with all of the different sectors in the community that represent law enforcement, school, medical, it's just a great way to, and a great mechanism, I think, to get that across to that. But we really got to do, a lot more within the community as well.
Looking at justice sanctions and justice support and police, I think that we're finding that they're taking that approach, and even a couple of the police chiefs in the area have said we can't arrest our way out of this. And so recognizing that if they are placed with someone that's coming to them and saying, I want help, I am willing to turn over all of my paraphernalia, but can I get help and not get arrested? And that's a different approach to it, because that we are, as Al said, it's not meeting the solution. If you incarcerate them and then they come out but haven't been given the tools to remain clean and sober, they're going to reoffend. They're not going to stay, clean and sober. And I think with some of the courts that we have, the OWI and the drug courts that we have, they're looking at that too. They're looking at, there are some sanctions that are against them if they reuse or relapse, but there is also opportunities for treatment and programming and groups and those sorts of things. And I think that didn't exist years ago. A few years ago, those kind of courts didn't exist at all. And so there is an understanding that we've got to do more than just arrest. And we recognize that people need to be held accountable. But yet, if we don't treat the underlying reason for them doing the criminal acts that they're doing, they're going to continue to do those.
There's a more of an awareness that I've seen in law enforcement over the years. I mean, cops used to be cops, counselors were counselors, and there was no middle ground. And what I've seen happen is the toughest redneck, so to speak, coppers that I've known for many years are finally actually sitting down and listening to some of the conversation and the dialogue. I think we have a new appreciation for the treatment community that we've never had before, and I think we've all realized that it takes that collaboration. In terms of the street user or the addict, I think that's probably the biggest place that I've seen an awareness grow from a law enforcement standpoint. My job as a law enforcement group is to enforce the law, make arrests, and make these people realize that you're not welcome here in our communities. We don't want you. Go back to wherever you came from, or simply stop being a drug dealer, and then we'll welcome you. But we don't necessarily go after the people that are, we could go out and buy heroin and buy methamphetamine undercover every day of the week, multiple times a day. But it's the enterprise, the business, the large dealers, that's our focus in terms of law enforcement. Those are the enterprises and businesses that we're trying to put out of business.
Yeah, an interesting term is a for-profit dealer. And I know a number of dealers and people who have dealt drugs, but it's been primarily to help sustain their habit. And those aren't the folks that Tom's talking about. He's talking about the folks that are coming into our community that are profiting from it and not having, because they aren't invested in the community, they're from outside the community, they're not seeing the effects that they're having in the community. So those are the ones that we're really happy to see that focus on them.
Cheryl Hancock from Cooley Council on Addictions is here with us today to talk about how communities are addressing an increasing meth use in western Wisconsin. She's joined by Tom Johnson, Investigative Coordinator for the West Central Metropolitan Enforcement Group, and Al Bliss, Health Educator for the La Crosse County Health Department. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on the rise of meth in Wisconsin. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about the rise of methamphetamines in Wisconsin. A study by the Wisconsin Department of Justice and the FBI found meth use increased by 300% between 2011 and 2015. Communities in western Wisconsin have seen meth use continue to grow as more of the drug is trafficked from the state from Minnesota. Joining us to talk about efforts to combat increasing meth use are Tom Johnson, Investigative Coordinator for the West Central Metropolitan Enforcement Group, Cheryl Hancock, Executive Director of Cooley County Council on Addictions, and Al Bliss, Health Educator for the La Crosse County Health Department. And Cheryl, you know, we've been talking a lot about, you know, how meth use can impact an individual, but I wonder if you want to talk about, you know, why is this something that the community really should be, you know, concerned with? Why is helping people with addiction, I guess, a larger kind of societal issue?
Well, actually, a few years ago, the organization underwent a strategic plan, and their focus had previously been on dealing with and supporting the individual who was struggling with addiction, their substance use disorder. And they found that the reality is that it affects families. And I would say since coming to Cooley about a year and a half ago, the number of phone calls that we receive, it is almost 50-50 between it being the individual who is looking for help for themselves or families who are looking to help a loved one that they have that's struggling with some sort of substance use disorder. And so if a family is affected, then you know extended families affected, and then you know that communities are affected. And again, when you talk about safety and security, you talk about productivity in the workplace, you talk about absenteeism and all of those sorts of things, it has a bigger issue than just that individual. And so as the family sees their loved ones struggling, they see them doing things that they wouldn't normally do, they see them becoming sick, they see them undergoing criminal behavior or stealing from family members themselves and then pawning it. I mean, that's a huge issue. And a huge way that addicts support their addiction is by taking things from family members and pawning them and then using those proceeds. You also see it in just with some of the things you see from Walmart, where people will come in and they'll return things that they had a receipt from, but it really wasn't something that they had purchased, but they were able to use that receipt and turn it around and be able to get money. It does affect the community, because when people are without those dollars to support their habits, then they have to turn to criminal behavior in order to get those dollars. And we see that each and every day. And so it is, whether it's someone having a health crisis or someone overdosing and dying or someone taking on that criminal behavior, it does affect the community.
Yeah, and Cheryl, you're talking about how, people with addictions, that can have a big impact on the people around them. And I know, Al, you have kind of a personal experience with this. And I wonder if you might share, obviously, not going into too much detail and protecting privacy, but share, kind of your experience.
Sure. So I have a brother who's addicted to methamphetamine, and he's fairly far away, several states at least, but we often have conversations at least by phone. But, for my brother, it didn't start that way. He didn't start just waking up and say, I want to use meth. It really started with him, I believe it was marijuana use. After a number of years, developed the tolerance, can't get some of that high again. You go on to other drugs. And now he is 47 years of age, and I know he's been using at least for several years. I'd like to think of him as being a low-level user that could still function and do that. But unfortunately for him, I know that it's cost him a marriage. It's cost him, the loss of employment. And while I thank God that my parents are there to help support him, to do that, these are the kind of things that I think really, it's like, how do you get someone to turn around or to realize it when the very drug itself impacts their judgment and their thinking? I can tell you it was almost impossible to have a conversation with them. Extremely paranoid, extremely irritated. I believe that everybody was out there and against him. And besides that, he did lose, and Tom will probably explain this later, he lost over 50 pounds of body weight, went from about 180 down to about 125 or 130. Had severe dental problems, from craving some of the sugary foods and soft drinks and all that. Of course, us as kids, we probably had poor food habits to begin with, but regardless of that, you go on for days with on a run for several days without sleep and that. So you're not rested. You're just not functioning well. And besides that, I recall him having talking on the phone, and besides being really paranoid, he would have often complain of chest pains. And he was, besides using, he was actually what I would say was a fit individual who didn't have high blood pressure, didn't have cardiovascular disease, and the impact that this drug has on your cardiovascular system is unbelievable. It just damages it, and along with other organs, because of the chemicals that just don't belong in the body. So, it's taken. I know my parents have really encouraged him to seek support and to do that and to be on the phone. I know they've driven out there numerous times and have stayed for, you know, even, you know, a few weeks or so on end. And I'm sure that's greatly helped them. And thankfully, there's kind of a good end to it, at least for now, is that for about 9 months, I've been able to have some good conversations with him again. And I really don't think that he has been using for those 9 months, because he cares, he wants to turn things around. You know, he wants to be part of the family. Him and I, we really didn't have a relationship much in, you know, in high school in the early years. And now he wants that. And I do too. And I think that's really important. So family members do need to support them. And I know he's also, you know, he's also, since his divorce, he's seeked a girlfriend too. You know, and just those things. And they bicycle together and they make some of these other healthy choices. I'm sure he's got a long road to go, but he also recently got employment as well. So I'm really proud of where he's going, and I hope that can continue. But that's just kind of a real short overall situation.
Yeah. Well, and we really appreciate you sharing your
sure.
personal experience, because, you know, Tom, I just wonder, you know, your thoughts are on how this, you know, meth use can kind of impact anyone and everyone, and how, you know, we've talked earlier about there isn't a particular, you know, location or necessarily age, you know, that it's kind of broad.
Well, it is, and I think we've alluded to a little bit about the mental and physical ramifications of meth use. The physical ramifications are basically increased blood pressures, increased heart rates, which can lead to death as compared to the instant death, so to speak, from heroin. So it's a longer range. Sure, I already talked about that. We have something we call meth mouth. What happens is the oral cavity becomes so dry that the natural acids eat away at the enamel of your teeth, and so your teeth are just literally destroyed. The other thing is the meth bugs. And that's an illusion that people have, that there are bugs crawling under their skin, and they literally scratch and claw away at their skin with their fingernails, creating abscesses and sores and so forth. So meth users can be quite apparent when you meet someone. The other thing is we call it tweaking. Their rapid movements, and they're constantly on at ease, you know, with things that are around them. They have a sense of paranoia about everything that's going on around them. So it's a lot of serious impact that it has on people.
That's investigator Tom Johnson from the West Central Metropolitan Enforcement Group here with us today to talk about trends in meth use affecting Western Wisconsin. Also joining us is Al Bliss from the La Crosse County Health Department and Cheryl Hancock from Cooley Council on Addictions. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. You know, we've been talking a lot about the, you know, increasing use of meth in this area and, you know, kind of all the different signs and symptoms of that in our community. But I know that also coming up is a community drug forum that's being put on. And I wonder if, Al, if you can share a little bit more details about this event and how people can, you know, kind of learn more about these issues.
Sure. May 15th is our community drug forum from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at the Stony Creek Inn, right in Onalaska. And just an hour prior to that, we will have resources from treatment, prevention, and support staff, different agencies that will also be available. And this is really a great opportunity to learn more about drug issues in our community from the local experts. In fact, both Tom Johnson and Cheryl Hancock are going to be panelists and presenters. And specifically, Tom's going to be talking about methamphetamine, you know, at the drug forum. So that's going to be definitely something, I think, that if you're concerned either for a loved one or you just want to learn a little bit more about what type of strategies that are currently being done, but there's also an opportunity to interact and ask questions with the panelists and the other speakers. The other unique thing I believe to this event is the Liebert family, who presented last year. There was a family of four. They talked about their family's road to recovery. They're going to return, but they're doing something a little bit different. It's called the wake-up call. And the wake-up call really is it's a life-sized exhibit of like a teen's bedroom with about 20, we call them red flags or signs that may be a signal for drug use. And this could be from anything from hiding a hollowed out light bulb that I know Tom's given this example before where they might use it, where they hollow it out and they use it to smoke meth or something else. And then there's more subtle things that they can look at, drug paraphernalia and ways that teens try to cover it up. So I think it'd really be a good opportunity. In fact, this is going on in the community already right now. It's just that this is another opportunity. The wake-up call event is going on in the community right now. But you can go and see this specific event during the May 15th Drug Forum.
Yeah, and Cheryl, can you talk a little bit about why, events like this are important for kind of addressing the larger issues with addiction in our community?
Well, I think many people will reach out to Cooley and seek advice or help. They may reach out to their health systems to seek the same thing, but a lot of times people just don't know what to do and where they can go for help. And that's one of the things about the Drug Forum is there are going to be resource tables available for folks that if they want to come and see what services are available, they can do that and do it in kind of a nondescript way where it doesn't mean a phone call, because people still are uncomfortable with making that call in some of the bigger health systems. Well, where do I go? Who do I ask for? And then they're not necessarily going to talk to someone who may be a provider. And so this gives them an opportunity to hear some of that information, but then to also seek out some of the resources and maybe get a little guidance there one-on-one of where to go.
We've been talking with Cheryl Hancock, Executive Director of Cooley Council on Addictions, Al Bliss, Health Educator for the La Crosse County Health Department, and Tom Johnson, Investigative Coordinator for the West Central Metropolitan Enforcement Group, about the rise of meth use in western Wisconsin in light of an upcoming community drug forum coming up on May 15th. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to more information on the Community Drug Forum.